on this episode of Skeptico.
Everything that I saw from the data about HIV testing did not fit with the idea of it being a sexually transmitted infection.
And again, that's the impetus of your argument, as I get it, which is that it just doesn't fit. Not that you know what the answer is or
right.
that you have some insight into the cure for AIDS or the cause for AIDS or anything like that, but it's just that you keep stumbling across this obvious problem with the existing theory. Another piece I ran across in your work is, you know, African American women in the United States. This is from the UN, the official group for publishing this data. But if you're an African American woman in the United States, 2010, 20 times more likely to be HIV positive. How could this possibly fit with the existing idea of how AIDS is spread, contracted, how HIV is spread, contracted? And am I right there? Is it?
You're right. I mean, they go through extraordinary contortions to try to offer explanations for that. But the thing is that in 20 or 25 years, HIV AIDS has supposedly changed from a disease largely restricted to gay white men into something that largely affects the black community, and especially black women.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this show, a dialogue I've been looking forward to for a long time. You know, it was probably 5 or 6 years ago that I first heard about our guest, Dr. Henry Bauer, and I heard about him through what seemed to me at the time a very strange and radical idea he had about the relationship between AIDS and HIV. Now, my journey through that, I think, is kind of telling because it's about my Skeptico journey in general, and that I heard this guy and I realized right away that he had some very solid credentials and he seemed like a really smart guy, and he was associated with the Society for Scientific Exploration, an organization I knew that had very high standards, and yet he was saying this really radical thing. And I investigated it, but I really only scratched the surface, and then I did something. I floated that idea out there. I think it was in a forum poster in response to someone that, hey, you know, maybe this AIDS HIV thing isn't what we think. And I just got beaten down, battered by whoever responded and said, you idiot, you know, here is this and here is this research and, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And I didn't know what I was talking about. And I really didn't have the time or the inclination to investigate it very much further. But I always had it in the back of my mind. So when the opportunity came up to talk to Dr. Bauer and I got my hands on his book, Dogmatism in Science and Medicine, I saw it as a real opportunity for the new 3.0 me, who is a little bit smarter, a little bit more savvy about how these research monopolies and knowledge cartels are formed and protected and how dogmatism in science exists. I thought it was a great opportunity to jump in and investigate it through this dialogue, and I'm really glad I did. I hope you'll enjoy this dialogue. We talk about a number of things, including why science is so dogmatic, how bad it really is for dissenters. Spoiler alert, it's really, really bad. I know I sometimes sound very pessimistic about the prospects for science. I think I'm even more so after hearing some of the tales that Dr. Bauer has to tell. We also talk about what can be done. I'm not sure much can, but Dr. Bauer has some ideas. And a little bit about the specific case of the relationship between AIDS and HIV, which I think is fascinating because, as you'll find out, the big picture data doesn't really support what you've been told about that relationship. So I greatly enjoyed this dialogue. I hope you'll enjoy it too. Here's my conversation with Dr. Henry Bauer. Today we welcome Dr. Henry Bauer to Skeptico. Dr. Bauer is a distinguished academic, a chemist by training, whose interest in science studies led him to become the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Virginia Tech. He's the author of several books, including Dogmatism in Science and Medicine, How Dominant Theories Monopolize Research and Stifle the Search for Truth. Henry, it's a great pleasure to have you on Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, you know, your book covers a topic that I think many of our listeners are going to be very familiar with. That is the dogmatism that you find in science, or I guess I always say science as we know it, because science means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And when you start bashing science, a lot of people want to talk about the pure science and the ideals of science. But I've always maintained that we can only talk about the science that we deal with, that we confront in our day-to-day lives, that we confront in universities, that is taught to us and to our kids and all the rest of that. So, and I think that's the science that you're really talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the most important points, that people's general impression of science has to do with ideals, and ideals that were based on science several centuries ago, and it's just not applicable to science nowadays.
Can you tell us a little bit, Henry, how you first became interested in these ideas? I get the sense that you're maybe a little bit of a contrarian to begin with, but I mean, here you are, you're moving along as a professional, an academic, and all these ideas that you're talking about really couldn't have, you must have saw early on that these were not good career moves for you to kind of take these positions.
Absolutely not. And I actually didn't start life as a contrarian, I don't believe. I was turned on to chemistry in high school and went through the usual sort of training and postdoced, and did research and taught chemistry, and but I always read very widely, and one day I picked up a book called Loch Ness Monster, and I knew, like everybody knows, that Loch Ness Monster is a myth and it's an old wives' tale and so on. But as I leafed through the book, I found stills from a film that the author claimed to have taken of the of this creature. So I borrowed the book and read it, and I couldn't make up my mind whether the author was telling a true story. Certainly, if he had a film of something moving in the loch, then there was something there to be explained. So then I wanted to find out what science says about it, and I couldn't find anything. You know, the encyclopedias had one little paragraph, nothing in the professional literature, and that started me wondering why science ignores some things that so many people are interested in.
Mm-hmm. So at that point, independent of whether or not you could establish this kind of cryptozoological fact that this thing did exist or not, you just took it that, hey, there's a lot of people who are really interested in this, and there's some evidence that it might be true. Why isn't it being investigated?
Exactly. So I read whatever I could about it, and I joined something called the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau that sent out newsletters. I was in Australia at the time, by the way. And then in the mid-60s, I emigrated to the States, and in the early 70s, I took a sabbatical leave to do some chemistry at Southampton in England, and I took a spring vacation trip up to Loch Ness, and believe it or not, I met there the author of that book that had first got me interested in it, and he taught told me about some underwater photographs that had just been taken. And so I began to be serious about the possibility of that creature. And when I got back from sabbatical, I was at the University of Kentucky, and it was just very high on interdisciplinary research projects. They thought that was the coming thing. So I thought, we'll put in a grant to study scientists' attitudes towards things like the Loch Ness Monster. And I had a group of a historian and a sociologist and a philosopher, and we put in a grant proposal, and it was not granted, but several of the commentators said, look, if you want to study a really substantial topic of scientists not taking things seriously that they should, why don't you look into the Velikovsky affair? Well, I'd never heard of that. But I thought I better had, and so I read up on that. Velikovsky was a psychoanalyst who, around 1950, published a book that was a popular bestseller, called Worlds in Collision, in which he interpreted all sorts of biblical references and old legends and so on, in terms of a scenario where a comet had come out of Jupiter and came close to Earth, and that explained the parting of the Red Sea and things of that sort. And of course, he was viciously attacked by scientists. But when I read about their attacks, I was taken aback, because what they were doing were really criticizing Velikovsky's qualifications, his approaches and so on, but they were not really grappling with the specific substantive claims he had made, like that Venus would turn out to be hotter than people presently thought, and that Jupiter would be found to be issuing radio noise, which was not known at that time. So it seemed to me that scientists were not really behaving scientifically in approaching these issues that Velikovsky had raised. And so I decided to write a book called Velikovsky and the Loch Ness Monster, about one thing, the Velikovsky claims, which turn out not to be well-founded, and the other one, the Loch Ness business, one where the claims are pretty well-founded. And it became too much for one book, and those were my first two books in sort of being skeptical about how science behaves. But the most important result was that through my publisher sending these drafts of books out for critiquing, I met Marcello Truzzi, who was a sociologist long interested in scientific unorthodoxies, and he was in on a newly founded society, the Society for Scientific Exploration. And through becoming a member of that group, I came to realize how many different fields of science are ignoring strong evidence of unorthodox phenomena. So then I never really looked back. I was so interested in those things that I decided I wanted to change my academic career from chemistry to history and philosophy, sociology of science, which nowadays is called science studies or science and technology studies. And to make that change, I needed some respite from being a professor of chemistry, where, of course, I was expected to do chemistry all the time and to get grants in that. And so I looked for some, for an administrative job to give me time to get qualified in history and sociology of science. And I was lucky enough to get the job here at Virginia Tech, which has just turned out marvelously well for me. But when you mentioned that these interests are hardly good for building a career, one of the things that I did pretty consciously was not to set myself up as someone who was claiming the validity of any of these particular things. I was doing scholarly studies of the controversies about these things. You know, that's a legitimate sort of thing to do when you're someone working in science studies.
Yes, I think you make that distinction very nicely, although sometimes you do let slip in there a little bit of your research, which is to be I'm glad you do. And I love the kind of phrase that I think captures a lot of this is the suppression of competent minority views. And
yeah,
that's what I think you're kind of battling against. In your book, you introduce two phrases that I think encapsulate a lot of the ideas you're talking about: knowledge monopolies and research cartels. Tell folks real quickly what you mean.
Yeah, knowledge monopolies I would define as something that has come to be so generally accepted that almost everybody believes it to be true, and anybody who denies it is more or less automatically regarded as a kook.
A couple of quick examples that you mentioned in the book and that some people will be familiar with. One is HIV causes AIDS. Second, global warming. A third is Big Bang Theory. All of these are outlined in the book, and I think, again, the position you take is not coming out strongly that a particular contrary view deserves our overthrowing of the consensus view, but just that there needs to be more of a give and take of exploring the incompleteness of the accepted knowledge monopolies. Would you agree with
yeah,
that?
Yes, exactly. I think I acknowledge that I personally happen to be on the dissident side of those things. But the point of the book is not to convince other people of that. It is to convince people that there hasn't been a proper engagement between the mainstream view and the dissident view. That's really the crux of the problem, that you can publish critiques in some pretty well-established publishing houses, but you cannot force the prevailing experts to answer. And so you have these, in effect, research cartels, because nowadays it's very difficult to find any areas in which you can do research without considerable resources, which means that the research that gets done is pretty much determined by the people who hold the purse strings. And those people take their advice, of course, from the recognized mainstream experts. So there's a lack of a forum, a lack of a place where the two or more points of view can engage in a substantive way where they can argue in a way that they're forced to answer one another specifically, that they cannot evade one another. And I've come more and more to the notion that what we need is a so-called science court. This is something that was actually proposed 50 or more years ago. Just after the Second World War, there was a lot of to-do about the possible safety or otherwise of nuclear power.
Yeah, but Henry, I think a science court misses the point, which is what's really behind these knowledge monopolies and what's really behind these research cartels. So if I can, I want to set that aside for just a second, and we'll get back to it because it's a point I think is very interesting. But what I want to do is, you know, this idea that you're talking about, I think everyone kind of nods their head until you get into the specifics, and then it kind of drives it home. Here is your position statement, as I understand it, on the HIV-AIDS connection. And now it should be noted, because this is your point, really, that for this, you have been kind of tarred and feathered as an AIDS denialist, homophobic, every other horrible thing that can be thrown at you from an ad hominem attack basis has been thrown on you. And here is what I understand to be your position statement. Substantive grounds for doubting that HIV is the necessary and sufficient cause of AIDS and that antiretroviral treatment is unambiguously beneficial. So now if we really kind of tear that apart, I mean, I read that and that doesn't sound anything too radical, really. You're just saying, hey, there might be grounds for doubting that this is, that HIV is always in every case necessary and sufficient for causing AIDS. You're not saying that there isn't any link there, but that the link isn't maybe the way we've thought it to be. And secondly, you're saying that for that reason, maybe this antiretroviral treatment, which we spend billions and billions of dollars on a global basis, maybe that isn't unambiguously beneficial. Maybe it isn't beneficial in every single case. So for this, you are an AIDS denier. So I think the first thing to do would be to back this up a little bit. And I don't want to get too far into the details of this because, again, your book talks about broader issues of science. But we have to give specific examples because I think this alone, for people who are uninitiated, will come as somewhat of a shock, and they will be in that same position that a lot of other people are, is, hey, this guy's wacky. Right. He's an AIDS denier.
Right.
Give us some fast facts that just kind of make this glaringly true.
Well, my general interest in scientific unorthodoxies led me to read whatever I could, wherever I would find out about somebody that denied a mainstream position. And so in the mid-1950s, I came across the fact that some people claimed that HIV doesn't cause AIDS. So I read quite a bit about that, and then...
This is in when, the
1990s. There was a book by Ellison and Duisberg about it. And so it was interesting. I didn't come down on one side or the other, but around 2003 or 2004, Harvey Bialy published what he called a scientific biography of Peter Duisberg, who was the main dissident against HIV/AIDS theory. And in that book, there was a statement that I knew simply couldn't be true. It said that when the army first started to test new recruits for HIV, and that was in the mid-1980s, they found that teenage women from all over the country in the United States were HIV positive as often as teenage boys. Now, that couldn't be true because the official position was that HIV came to the United States around the late 1970s, and it came in only amongst groups of gay men in a few large cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York. Well, a sexually transmitted disease, largely transmitted between among gay men, could not possibly have spread all over the United States in half a dozen years in such a way that you would find teenage women in Montana being HIV positive as often as teenage boys there. So I thought that statement couldn't be correct. I looked up the original reference. That's what the primary source said. You never can accept a single source in science, so I looked at other data about HIV testing in the 1980s. And I tell you this, it became the most emotionally difficult time that I can remember as an adult, because everything that I saw from the data about HIV testing did not fit with the idea of it being a sexually transmitted infection.
And again, that's, I think, the impetus of your argument, as I get it, which is that it just doesn't fit. Not that you know what the answer is or right. that you have some insight into the cure for AIDS or the cause for AIDS or anything like that, but it's just that you keep stumbling across this obvious problem with the existing theory. Another piece I ran across in your work is, you know, African-American women in the United States. This is from the UN, the official group for publishing this data. But if you're an African-American woman in the United States, 2010, 20 times more likely to be HIV positive. How could this possibly fit with the existing idea of how AIDS is spread, contracted, how HIV is spread, contracted? And am I right there? Is it?
You're right. I mean, they go through extraordinary contortions to try to offer explanations for that. But the thing is that in 20 or 25 years, HIV/AIDS, has supposedly changed from a disease largely restricted to gay white men into something that largely affects the black community and especially black women. And, you know, it makes no sense. When I had first analyzed collected those data on HIV tests, I wrote to the CDC to ask them, are these regularities I'm seeing real? And if so, how do you explain them? I didn't get a reply for a while. I had to keep pushing. But eventually I got a short reply saying that the regularities that I saw are genuine, they're real, but the difference between white and black can be explained on a behavioral basis.
Yeah, they don't realize what they're stepping into there, but I guess they've gotten away with it, so why not?
Yeah, they have, and you know, that it's about as racist a stereotype as you can imagine.
Completely, and where's the data to back that up?
Actually, I found a number of references that tell you the contrary. There are some sociological studies that seem to find that black people are a bit more careful in their sexual relationships than white people are in the U.S. and in Africa. But, you know, at the very least, there's absolutely no evidence that black people are more likely to be sexually promiscuous in this extraordinary way.
One of the things you do a great job of doing in the book, Henry, is personalizing
this story from the standpoint of a scientist. And tell us a little bit about what you've encountered, because you have run across people who have been blindsided by this. I mean, they're competent, hardworking scientists that are kind of plugging along in their field, and they unknowingly stumble into a situation where they find themselves running up against one of these monopolies, and they really are blindsided, aren't they? They tell us some of the cases you run into.
Absolutely blindsided. I mean, Peter Duisberg is the outstanding example of that. He was one of the most widely acclaimed virologists, in fact, retrovirologists. He got one of the most eminent research grants from the National Institutes of Health, a grant that gets you funded for 7 years without you having to reapply for it. He was elected to the National Academy of Sciences as a young, relatively young researcher. And all that happened was that when in the early days of the AIDS discovery, he wrote an article from the basis of his knowledge of retroviruses, saying, you know, a retrovirus can't do what it's being claimed it can do. All of a sudden, he was excommunicated. Robert Gallo, who was head of the National Cancer Institute, who had introduced Duisberg in glowing terms for a seminar a little while earlier, turned round completely and would not even discuss the question with Duisberg. In fact, he and other people actually threatened to boycott conferences if Duisberg was allowed to attend. Totally extraordinary situation. Gordon Stewart is a British or Scottish epidemiologist who was a consultant to the World Health Organization, amongst other things. And when the AIDS business started, he pointed out that all of the data indicated that it was not a sexually transmitted disease because it was not leaving the original risk groups. This was in the 1980s, where up until about the early 1990s, HIV and AIDS were pretty much found only amongst gay men. In Britain, where Stewart was taking the data, as well as in the United States. And Stewart was unable to get his studies published, even though, you know, he was personally known to people in the professional societies. And as I say, he had an eminent career as an epidemiologist. Here he was writing about epidemiology, his specialty, and he was being suppressed. He wasn't being listened to. And as a matter of fact, you know, his unpublished articles have been borne out by later data too. His predictions were correct, and the opposing predictions were wrong.
In the book, you have an idea for how this has come about. And one of the claims you make is that this is a relatively recent phenomena that we find in science.
Yes.
The extent to which these monopolies and cartels exert their influence, you make the claim that in your career, you've seen a shift.
Yeah.
Tell us what you think is behind that.
It's money, to put it in the simplest possible way.
But how's the money changed?
Science has become important. Back in the 1930s, up into the 1930s, The general societal view was that, you know, science is a good thing and we know about these great people like Darwin and Einstein and so on. But what people were doing didn't require much money, and the consequences of what they were finding out didn't seem to be of startling importance for any near-term big ventures or big money-making things. Second World War changed all sorts of things. That's when penicillin, antibiotics came in, and medicine supposedly could become scientific and do wonders in terms of saving people's lives. And of course, the atom bomb showed that physicists were able to do things that could lead to nations winning wars. So after the Second World War, there was a tremendous expansion of money to train new scientists and to fund science. And when I came to the States in the mid-60s from Australia, it was a golden era. Just about anybody who was trained in science at just about any university or college could get funding. And what has happened is that the number of people supposedly engaged in scientific research has expanded enormously. And the amount of money being poured into it expanded enormously. And then there came a bit of a crisis, because the amount of resources just couldn't keep up with the demand.
Well, with the demand in one respect, I think the scenario you paint very nicely is that in some respects, I see it as a kind of classic labor versus management issue. In that, yeah, there's this period where there's this just kind of free money, everyone's flowing around, and then people are learning where to find the cheese. So they're kind of following the path and get more research grants, get more publications, get more students, churn out more PhDs. And everyone's kind of going along these assumptions. And at one point, somebody turns around and shuts down the faucet on the money and says, hey, we need to get some results off of this. Again, classic management employees,
right.
You know, the labor pool is saying, we just want to do our job. We just want to be creative. And management is saying, hey, it's up to my bottom line. I want to make money off of it.
That's part of it. But there is also another part of it, and that is that so many research universities got established, or other colleges turned into research universities, and all of those wanted to pour out as many graduates and potential researchers as possible, but the market was saturated.
Right.
There were about 100, 115 or so PhD-granting universities in the 1940s, and 30 years later in the United States, there were three times as many. So, and, you know, the cutthroat nature of research now goes like this. If you're a biologist and you're applying for a grant to the National Institutes of Health, which is the main funding source, your chances of getting a grant are less than 1 in 5. Think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, the average age at which a young or new investigator gets their own individual grant as a principal investigator is in the early 40s. You're essentially in a limbo depending on other people until you're in your early 40s. I mean, it's become a ridiculously cutthroat and ineffective situation.
Well, it just shifts the power more and more to those funding agencies, be they the National Institute for Health or Big Pharma or Big Oil or Big Whoever. They now can really demand more and influence more, and that's not necessarily healthy.
That's right. They control things, and the people who control things, including the established people in academe, are not going to give up their status and their privileges. And part of that status and privilege, of course, depends on the theories that they claim to be true. So we've got a circumstance where new ideas don't just meet the normal sort of resistance that human beings have to new ideas, but the old ideas are entrenched by a tremendous group of vested interests who control the funding and the publication and the promotion and so on.
And that's really kind of a tricky issue, isn't it? Because I think we're conditioned to think that science is all about innovation, but also that industry is all about innovation.
Yeah.
And that these breakthrough products and breakthrough technologies are what's really driving industry. And when you really pull it apart like you do, you really find that in many respects, industry is anti-innovation, especially disruptive technologies. So if you're, for example, in the business of refining and distributing oil products, then you really don't have a strong vested interest in low-energy nuclear reaction, or cold fusion, as it's known. Yeah, that's a technology that completely disrupts your way of business. And the same thing is true in pharmaceuticals and every place else. So I think we have to sort out what kind of innovation is really allowed, and it becomes a pretty narrow little path that these guys can walk. Right?
Yeah, because it's the bottom line of profit that is the driving force, and that is made all the so much worse because of all the conglomeration that has gone on. I've read quite a bit recently about the pharmaceutical industry, for example, and 50 years ago, there were lots of rather small drug companies, and CEOs of those companies typically were people with MD degrees or who had been in research. Nowadays, drug companies are a relatively small number of conglomerates, and the CEOs typically come from sales, marketing, or business management. It's a completely different cast of mind. And the notion that profits come first then are imposed from the top. You know, when people worry or criticize government bureaucracy, it's not generally recognized that bureaucracy is just as bad in large companies. You get bureaucracy whenever there are big enterprises, and you've got hierarchies, and you've got subdivisions, and you've got separation of responsibilities. And so you can have some very dysfunctional situations coming about.
Well, let's talk a little bit about conspiracies, because you pull up short of drawing the line between these instances of dogmatism and monopolies and cartels in science and medicine and what are commonly referred to as conspiracy theories. In fact, you say knowledge monopolies are not willful conspiracies. Now, that sounds nice and safe, but is that really the case?
Well, I define conspiracy as people deliberately bringing about circumstances that they fully know are purely for their own benefit and not to anybody else's.
Well, that's a pretty narrow description, and it gets into be a slippery slope. Let me throw out a story.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a story, one that I'm sure you're probably familiar with, but there's probably many listeners who are not. And that's in 1985, Monsanto purchased a little company called Searle & Company because they had a patent on aspartame. you know, the little NutraSweet, the little blue thing, right? And the FDA had already banned aspartame because it was unsafe. But they went out, Monsanto and Searle went out, and they hired Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld. There is no Building 7. What's Building 7? Donald Rumsfeld, that guy, who vowed to call in his markers. Those were his words, to get it approved. Now, what's the result of that? If you go down any supermarket and pick up a can of Diet Coke, Diet Pepsi, any soft drink, and you read the back of it, it's got aspartame on it. You go to any restaurant, you get those little blue packets, aspartame. So here's a case where this is clearly a conspiracy. It's science is the pawn in the game. But what's really going on is big business. Billions of dollars made by Searle and Monsanto, millions and millions of dollars made by Rumsfeld. Many people don't realize the wealth that that guy accumulated from this single coup that he was able to pull off in terms of doing an end run on the FDA. Doesn't this kind of stuff go on time and time again, and it's just underneath our personal radar?
Well, Rumsfeld, by the way, is also making money through Gilead, which is one of the biggest manufacturers of the antiretroviral drugs, and in particular those that are being currently touted as a prevention against infection. But wow. Do you think Rumsfeld believed he was doing something wrong? See, I don't. I think human beings have a tremendous capacity for not seeing facts that contradict what their beliefs are, and a way of just shoving aside, not thinking about unpleasant things. Here's a possible scenario. Somebody comes to Rumsfeld and says, look, aspartame has got a bad reputation, an undeservedly bad reputation. Here are a couple of my well-qualified friends who can tell you about that. Can you help us to get around this situation?
Absolutely. I mean, in some respects, though, you're defining in the clearest way the origins of evil, right? I mean, however you define evil, I mean, that is it. It's always the end justifies the means. And every act that we could have, the most horrible acts that we can imagine, are justified in just that way.
Right. It's, what I would say is that human beings have, we all have a capacity to get caught up in things where later we would wish we hadn't. And that one part of what we need as a solution is a systemic situation where things can be done openly and where responsibility is seen to lie clearly. Secrecy is, you know, is a great help to the wrong things being done. Some of the people who have written about what's wrong with present-day medicine have pointed out that clinical trials of drugs can be carried out without the results being published if the people who carried them out don't want to publish them. So that a lot of drugs have apparently been approved because the FDA was given a couple of successful trials, and there were a dozen unsuccessful trials hidden away in drawers somewhere.
Mm-hmm. The file drawer problem.
Yeah.
Dr. Bauer, what are some practical and realistic changes that you'd like to see that could really come about? I mean, given that we're playing on a much bigger field than we can ever imagine, and we'll never know all the power structures that exist and what amount of influence they have. Realistically, what can be done and what might be done?
You've got to get some sort of political influence, and that's pretty difficult at the moment because things are so ideologically split. So you've got to try to find some sort of things that seem good to both sides. And I think that openness of critiquing and data and so on is one possibility for that. That's what I mean about the science court. What I would like to see is a situation where Peter Duisberg and Robert Gallo are presenting opposing sides in a forum where there are independent evaluators present, and each of them is allowed, perhaps with the assistance of lawyers or whatever, each is allowed to cross-examine the other person. So you would begin with a claim like carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is appreciably contributing to warming. Okay. The person proposing that is asked to provide the evidence. And then each little bit of evidence can be argued about, but it's got to be done in public where people can see how the reactions go. You know, one of the things I'm trying to tell people is you should not be afraid of judging technical issues. What you can do is you can look at the way in which people respond. If you ask Robert Gallo, what is the proof that HIV causes AIDS? He'll fly off the handle. He'll say, there have been hundreds and thousands of papers published about it. Why don't you go and read them? And this is not an answer. But the media have been letting him get away with it for 30 years. So I think forcing people to answer publicly is an important issue, isn't it? It would be an important contributor to things getting better. But I don't think it can be done effectively through committee hearings in Congress, because the observers and the media in particular automatically dismiss what the experts say who are on the other side of the political spectrum.
Well, and it's not always on the political spectrum. It's all often just they're very much into defending the status quo. And
sure,
we don't know exactly what is the impetus for that, what is the controlling factors for that, but it's clear and it's obvious. And as far as your other point and with the science court, I mean, a couple of obvious problems I see with it is one is that we're doing an end run on science now. we have to admit that the peer review process doesn't work, that the whole enterprise of unbiased investigation and discovery has kind of failed, and we need this kind of patchwork fix on the other end. I think a lot of people would have problems with that. But the bigger problem I see is the one that you mentioned, and I've experienced it in a small way on this show, and that's that what I've found is that when people don't talk, they're admitting defeat. So on so many controversial issues I've tackled, I've been able to get one person on board, and then when you try and get the other person on board, they go for a little while until they see that they really don't have a position, and then they back off, and they don't want to come out and publicly be exposed for their position. And they'll make all sorts of ruckus on the internet, and they'll say all sorts of inflammatory, outrageous things. But when you say, okay, let's engage, we'll do it on a neutral site, we'll do it on another show, I don't have to be involved, I'll just bring these two experts together. No, they won't have it. And whether they know on a conscious level that their ideas aren't going to stack up, or whether they've just kind of internalized it in some kind of subconscious way that, hey, don't go there, it could not look so good for me. I don't know, but I've seen it happen over and over again.
Yes, exactly. And that's precisely why we need some sort of a forum that, on the one hand, has social authority, and on the other hand, is not one-sided or biased. And the court system seems to be the best way that we've found so far of doing something like that, where, you know, the important thing in the court system is people cannot really evade the issues, and proceedings are open so that everybody can be informed about what is going on. At the moment, you have people on different sides of these so supposedly scientific issues. You have them talking past one another. I've put together a bibliography of critiques of medicine that has nearly 100 books and articles and so on it. And some of these books are by editors of the New England Journal of Medicine, professors at Harvard, eminent people publishing books from mainstream respected publishers, and nothing changes. They have pointed out the ills that have come from the domination by the pharmaceutical industry. They've given chapter and verse about it. They've documented fines that have been paid and how the drug company's behavior has not changed after they pay these fines because they're trivial compared to the profits they make from the illegal marketing and so on. But all of these books, many of them published in the last decade or so, it's really increasing dramatically. It hasn't changed. The mainstream professional associations and so on feel no need to respond.
Yeah, that's really, I think, one of the real dramatic changes and shifts is that dissent isn't what it used to be. It isn't valued the way it used to be. And in fact, it's turned the other way around, where no one does feel a need to kind of respond to the dissenters, other than if they can make a fool out of them or put them down. But the dissent is gone.
Right.
So, Dr. Bauer, where does this work take you from here? Obviously, you're still a part of the SSE, which is an important organization in advancing a lot of these ideas that don't fit in the mainstream, and you're still involved with that. Where is your work taking you? What are some of the topics that have really popped up into your radar as areas that maybe need our attention in terms of knowledge monopolies and research cartels?
I've gotten very much into medical matters, stimulated in part by personal experiences that led me to realize that the usual so-called biomarkers that are used are not really valid. You know, everybody believes blood pressure indicates the possibility of a risk of stroke and heart disease and heart attack and so on, and that cholesterol buildup is dangerous.
Right.
These are simply not true. Yeah. And there's even an Institute of Medicine report on biomarkers that says it flat out. It doesn't say it flat out. You've got to read between the lines. But the data they give show it quite clearly. And some other people I know who have personally suffered from it pointed out to me the catastrophe of psychiatric drugs. One of the most prominent psychiatrists, David Healy, has written a stunning book called Pharmageddon, in which he describes how over-prescribed drugs in general are, how incompetently or actually deliberately incompetently tested they are.
Right.
And it's really a disaster. You know, the labels, antidepressant, anti-anxiety, mood stabilizer, and so on, are totally unjustified because those drugs don't do the specific things that the label claims that they do. They give the brain a jolt.
And there's all sorts of other problems, right? I mean, just in terms of whether they're effective. I mean, antidepressants have been outed for the last at least 10, 20 years as being not more effective than placebo. And then there's also the decline effect that we have no idea. We have no idea what's going on in terms of why these clinical trials over time show less effectiveness. I mean, there's so many mysteries. One of the topics we've focused on mostly on this show is the whole issue of human consciousness, because I think it's in many ways at the center of this dogmatism. And that's this idea that all human experience is a product of the brain. And of course, this has been falsified not only philosophically, but experimentally over and over again. And, you know, I was just recently I interviewed Jeffrey Schwartz, who's a research psychiatrist at UCLA School of Medicine right out here in Los Angeles, who is another story for your book. You know, he does this groundbreaking research on OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, that clearly shows that this mind equals brain connection that is at the center of this idea of consciousness is falsified. And what he gets out of it is this, somebody, I think his head of department told him directly, look, you're lucky you still have a job. So kind of, you know, he openly admits, he goes, I am lucky I still have a job, because he sees how this is the kind of stuff that is career ending for a lot of people. So I'm not as optimistic as you are that change can really come. I think the more we dig into this, the mysteries get bigger and bigger. And some of the stuff that we play around with, I think, is small potatoes compared to some of the bigger paradigms that we've become stuck in that really keep us from moving forward.
Right. You may be the only person I know who's ever called me optimistic, by the way.
I think you are at heart. I can see it in your book. Again, it's been a great pleasure having you on. Folks, the book is Dogmatism in Science and Medicine, How Dominant Theories Monopolize Research and Stifle the Search for Truth. Our guest has been Dr. Henry Bauer. Again, Henry, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. I enjoyed it thoroughly. This was fun.
Thanks again to Dr. Henry Bauer for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up from this interview, and that is, how bad is it? I'm the guy who wrote the book Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything, and since writing that book 6 months ago, I gotta tell you, I'm more and more convinced that science is even more wrong than I imagined. I think Dr. Bauer's book adds a couple more weights on the side of the scale that says science is hopelessly running off the rails. But let's see what you think. Maybe it's not as bad as I think. The place to share your opinions on this or other shows is, of course, through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. Join us for a discussion on the forum or send me an email or connect with me on Facebook. I have a couple of good shows coming up. They're in the hopper waiting for me to put them out and then hopefully for you to listen to them. By the way, dude, share the Skeptico love with whoever you think might want to hear about it. Share links with your friends, write about us, blog about us. I know there's a lot of really smart people out there who write blogs and write books. It's always gratifying to hear you say that you like these interviews and you use them in your material and you link to them. So if that's something you feel inclined to do, please do it. Well, that's going to take care of this episode. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.